CataractCoach.com, podcast number 35 with Jay Parekh. Keen insight about the business aspects of ophthalmology. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have a great friend, an incredible ophthalmologist, an incredible businessman, and a leader in our field, Jay Parekh. Jay, welcome. I'm so honored to have you here on our podcast.
Uday, I'm beaming. It's a Friday afternoon. I just feel great being here with you. You and I go back a couple decades. We've all evolved. We've had a great journey together, and I just love your brand. It's not Cataract Coach. It's not Eye Coach. It's Life Coach. I'm really digging it. Your interviews the last couple of minutes have been awesome. You're doing good. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, we have a good time. We just kind of have a nice conversation, and we kind of go wherever it takes us, and we get to learn about the other person. Now, obviously, we've been friends for 20 years more than 20 years. And knowing each other very, very extensively. But I was always impressed by you because all ophthalmologists are smart. Bro, you're on another level of smart. You're very modest. I want to talk about, like, what's your path in ophthalmology? Why the MBA? When the MBA? And people may not know, you have experience on the C-suite, on the executive side for these companies, as well as, obviously, you're an ophthalmologist and a busy surgeon.
It's been fun. You know, we all have a journey. We all have a path. Mm-hmm. I've always been intrigued by business. It's probably part of my genes. Our gene pool is in business. I grew up in northern New Jersey. My parents weren't business people, but we knew the value of money. And I always looked at P&L, you know, profit and loss and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I was in a combined medical program, you know, straight through, you know, go to medical school, become a doctor, get married, have kids, that path. It's been a great path. I've been married.
You did 6 years though, like a bachelor's and MD all in six.
I did a combined program. I actually did. I did the actual 8 year option, but I did a combined program. Yes, I did. I was going to apply to a really famous business school, and I was going to get into that business school up in Boston. My father literally almost lunged across the kitchen chair and almost smacked me one. Said, "Am I going to make you a doctor or a businessman?" I'm like, "Dad, I want to be a leader. I want to lead. I don't want to go to McKinsey. I don't want to join a bank. I want to lead in healthcare and learn about the macro of what we do in healthcare." So nonetheless, I did not go to business school when I could have gone up in Boston. You know, did my training, was going to become a heart surgeon at one point, fell in love with my girlfriend who ended up becoming my wife, and she was going to do OB. She went into ophthalmology. I actually did medicine, full 3 years of medicine. Chief residency.
Oh, you did a full residency,
boarded, was headed for a career at the combined program up at Harvard for cardiology.
I gotta interrupt you. you're the sole ophthalmologist I know who, when we're on a plane and they say, "Is there a doctor on board?" You actually, like, you have the knowledge to take care of the patient.
Yeah, but unless I'm on earphones, I can't hear what they're saying. But yes, I could. John Shepherd's also a fully trained primary care doctor. But nonetheless, and I did some work at the Joslin Clinic. I was headed for a career in cardiology. I already had an interventional and an EP fellowship lined up. I was going to go into academics. I love silent ischemia. Did some work at the Joslin Clinic and came across the Aiellos, father and son. They convinced me, like, "Jay, you got some great hands. You have a good smile. You're great with people. You're just thinking about ophthalmology." I'm like, I'm married to an ophthalmologist. Think about it. And I made a career switch. Headed for cardiology, made a career switch, applied for opto. Swathi was in Boston. I wanted to stay in Boston. And I matched in the combined program for BU and at Tufts. Had a great time. Did a lot of cataracts, pediatric ophthalmology at Children's. It was an amazing training program. Yeah. And then did my fellowship. I was thinking about retina, but back then it was lights on, lights off. We didn't have injections and gene therapy and so forth. And I fell in love with cornea and better outcomes. I loved the ocular surface back then. Loved cataract refractive surgery. Loved corneal transplants. All my mentors up there, you know, Art Borikoff, Howard Leibowitz, were all big cornea guys. I actually was almost going to go to the Roger Steinert Fellowship up in Boston, but he was thinking of leaving. And then my mom fell sick, and I had to be back in New York, and thankfully I did because she passed away during my fellowship. So I matched in cornea at New York Eye and Ear with Mark Speaker, hung out with Tal Raviv at that time, got some great training in not only cornea, but refractive surgery and complications, and then went into a great practice. I was Wills affiliated down in South Jersey, and then realized that I wanted to be, you know, the managing partner of a group. Left there on good terms, and became the managing partner of a really prestigious group in Northern Jersey, and we've done great ever since then. I've been teaching at New York Eye and Ear. It's the hand that fed me in cornea. And I became interested in business once again, working with companies. Again, everyone wants to work with companies day one. You have to see patients. The majority of what you do to make an impact in what we do in our profession is you've got to see patients. You have to be doing cataract surgery, transplants, LASIK, retina, whatever you're doing. And you got to be good at it because people know the BS. They know the BS when you're on the podium. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of skepticism out there. There are a lot of professional speakers out there and so forth. And they're all great. But nonetheless, when companies need to make a decision, a business decision, business development, a marketing decision, they're going to count on people that are actually seeing patients. And you and I translate what happens in clinical development and in the corporate wings. We translate that in real time. We see patients. We think about getting sued. We take care of our patients, good outcomes. We operate at a surgery center, at a hospital. It's real time. But the touch between ophthalmology industry and practicing physicians is really amazing. And all our meetings that we've all become friends at has really been a great way to interface with the industry. So for me, after 5 years of working really, really hard, I started speaking. I think you and I started speaking at ISTA together on the same time. We were using Zybron back then. We worked very closely with the smaller companies. The bigger companies probably ignored us. We were just too young back then. But I love the smaller companies that have one or two products. We scaled them up, got them to the finish line. Very innovative companies. And then they all got swallowed up. That's what happens, right? That's what's happening right now as we see that in eye care. So it's been a great journey. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to continue doing more. So I actually went to business school down at Fuqua. I was sort of sick and tired of some of the elitism in the Northeast. They had a great healthcare program, got a full MBA. And then I was lucky enough, Terry could not go on this trip, Terry Kim, who you interviewed a couple weeks ago. And I was lucky enough to be a team ambassador as a physician for Coach K and the Duke basketball team in Dubai and China. That was a trip of a lifetime. That changed me on looking at basketball from a macro lens versus playing basketball in our backyards. So that was amazing for me. And I didn't do that I only did it for myself. But after business school, it was like refractive surgery, Uday. It was like going from a minus two to an emmetrope. And I looked at things differently. And I had offers to leave and go to some big consulting, some big banks, some hedge funds. But no, I wanted to stay as an ophthalmologist and contribute in a macro way. And I think I've had the ability to do that. You know, I do it in a team-oriented way. I've been part of some great societies that you're part of, you know, ACOS, you know, OSN, the boards and so forth. It's been fantastic. And then I got a call one day, Jay, would you ever want to consider going full-time in-house to help shape, you know, the next 5-6 years in eye care? And I had that opportunity at Allergan between 2015 and 2020 before AbbVie purchased them. And it was an amazing experience for me.
You stopped seeing patients then for those 5 years?
No, I went to boutique. I stopped doing all the hard cornea transplant cases. I stopped doing LASIK. I really focused on cataracts, ocular surface, and MIGS and glaucoma. I hated glaucoma in residency. Everyone had a 0.99 cup, NVG, NVI, and you know they all had an APD. Now it's amazing, and 54% of our patients at any given point in time have glaucoma. So I think I've been, you know, a force in the MIGS world as an anterior segment surgeon. I don't consider myself a corneal surgeon anymore or a cataract surgeon. I'm like you, I'm anterior segment. I do everything in the front part of the eye that I want to do after doing this now a couple decades. We can focus on what we want to do. It's like almost like the OBGYN. After 20 years, you stop delivering babies and you focus on what you like to do. So I'm in a great spot as you. You know, we're focusing on what we like to do, how I want to contribute to the macro of education, serving the industry, but then taking care of our patients in the operating room, in our waiting rooms, you know.
So I've got a few questions. So first, you did the Duke MBA at Fuqua. Fantastic program, one of the best in the country.
Yeah.
But you were living in New Jersey.
I flew down. every Wednesday afternoon. And I took Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays off. Went was there every other weekend, and I came back on Sunday mornings. And then during those 2 years, there were 4 2-week in residence programs. It's easy to do that when you're your own boss. If you're working in a big group and you're the junior partner, they're going to get pretty envious, maybe even jealous at times. So I was lucky enough to do that. But I kept my volume up. I became incredibly efficient. I curtailed my 5 days of work a week down to 3 days with some admin time. And I lost some hair, obviously, because the fail rate was 10% there. But you know, I graduated towards the top of my class. I enjoyed it. I made friends for life in healthcare. Some guys from McKinsey, BCG, banking, healthcare systems. It's something I recommend for a lot of people who want to think about business.
You did this solidly mid-career. You were probably, what, 40-ish at the time?
No, I was late 30s.
Late
30s.
Wow, that's tough to do.
And it was tough to do.
When you were doing the part-time practice, part-time with Allergan, how'd you split your week?
Well, I don't work 40 hours a week, Uday. I have had the mantra for years now, almost 2 decades. I live 168 hours a week.
Okay.
Okay? So if you work 40 hours a week, that's still 128 hours. Minus 7 hours of sleep a night times seven, that's 50 hours. If you look at that whole number, like McKinsey and math, and go backwards, mm-hmm. we have a lot of free time. And for me, it's made me incredibly efficient. So, you know, Allergan was a full-time job. I had you know, a lot of direct reports. It was a global role. I worked with clinical development, marketing, commercial, safety, business development. It was awesome. All the MSLs reported into one of our leaders that reported to me. I learned a lot. I was the expert in-house, but I learned a lot. Of course, I had to rescind all my relationships with other companies, so I was still friends with them for many, many years. And that was great because, you know what? It's like going to the baseball meetings. You know, the Yankees and the Red Sox can't stand each other on the fields, but at the baseball meetings, they're friends, they're colleagues. And I think what we were doing in eye care, we have a small specialty, is we elevate. Right. And we're all looking for, you know, common solutions for our patients. So it was great, but you know, I had to obviously stop everything and just concentrate on Allergan. You know, my email was J.Preck. I was chief medical officer and vice president of medical. And I also did 2 years in dermatology while I was there. Some of the leaders there wanted me to sort of go out of my comfort zone, and I loved it. I love dermatology. They do a lot of things outside of the payer mix. We do all the things inside the payer mix. So a lot of our friends in medical school that went to dermatology and ourselves, we're very similar in personalities, but they're a bit more outside of the payer mix. We're inside the payer mix, but it was great. And then when AbbVie took them over, they didn't have that role anymore. And then it led for a sequence of events for me to leave on a really, really good note. And you know, I've been consulting now ever since then on the commercial side there. So it's a lot of fun. I'm back to being a free agent, working with a lot of companies, private equity, very boutique. I still maintain my part-time practice, concentrating a lot on cataract surgery, MIGS, ocular surface. I still see around, you know, 1,000 to 1,200 patients a month, X number of days. But again, I live that 168 hours a week and I work backwards. Because who came up with this 40-hour work week? I have no idea. And the whole thing has been turned upside down, Uday, after COVID. Right? It's been turned upside down. So I think how we work, how we engage with people is really important. And when you're your own boss, you can work the way you want in a creative way. And I don't do weeknights as a physician. I do 2 Saturday mornings in Jersey. That works really well. And what works for you in LA and what works for me here in Northern Jersey, although there's money in both coasts, it's very different. It's just a very different ecosystem. So we've done very well in our practice, in our own ecosystem. We have a great standing in the community, and it's been fun. It's been a great trip. You know what? You and I are in our prime right now. We have a couple more decades left, and I just love eye care. I really do.
I think most ophthalmologists who I've met are like me and you, where we say, every day I'm thankful to be an ophthalmologist, every day. So it's an amazing thing. But, you know, I got a question to bring up, though. I used to be of the mentality of, well, I only work, quote, half-time. 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. is only 12 hours. That's 12 out of 24 hours. That's half of the day only. So I'm only working half-time. And obviously, 60 hours a week was on the low side because I used to do a Tuesday and Thursday night clinic till 8 p.m. And I used to quote Saturday mornings, which my mornings went from 7 a.m. to like 3 p.m. That was the quote morning.
Right.
But then at some point, though, I realized, like, I can work really hard. I'm a donkey. Medicine has trained me to, like, delay gratification. I can work like an absolute animal. And I can do that. But I don't know. Did I miss out on stuff in life? So I think, honestly, the younger generation is smarter than us.
They are.
They figure out a better balance because while there are 24 times 7 equals 168 hours in a week, I get it. I need 8 hours sleep, by the way, not just 7. what's the balance? I don't know. So, yeah, you've got to figure out what makes you happy, what your passion is. And then you also brought at the beginning of the conversation something very important, which is your practice in terms of what you do surgically has evolved.
Oh, without a doubt.
Your practice in how you spend your time has also evolved.
Look, we are the iPhone 15 of where we were the iPhone 4 many years ago. And you and I are both wearing a nice black t-shirt to emulate Steve Jobs. I use Apple, what they've done in business there, and I translate that a lot to what I can do as an eye care provider, as a consultant for some companies. You have to keep on innovating yourself, but innovate yourself in a way that creates access for the worst thing any company can do is create this awesome new molecule, right? This awesome new product, this device, but no one can afford it. And the healthcare insurance will make you go through hurdles and so forth. So for me, it was really important, you know, when I was at Allergan and other companies that I've consulted with, to say, how do we translate this so a greater number of people can get the product? Not just only in the US, even outside the US, right? We now live in a global sphere of influence. Eye care is truly global. We go to ACOS, we go to the BMC meetings out there. Everyone's talking and so forth. You know, you meet great leaders like Cummings and Ashwin Agarwal, great guys. And it's really become one sphere of influence. But again, Apple, you go there and they have innovation there every 6 to 9 months with all the different products, different offerings. It's cool. All ages are there. All creeds are there. And everything is relatively affordable. Relatively affordable, right?
Sure.
And that's what we have to do. Because an eye care vision is an incredibly amazing sense for us. And as elite as we want to be, all of our patients want 20/20 vision, 20/10 vision, right? Whether we give them a multifocal lens, a femto multifocal lens option, or an LRI that you've been an expert in now for decades, it's really important. So that's what I do. I always want to be there. My parents raised me with, you know, I think strong middle class values, and I just want to make sure everyone that we touch can be touched in a really broad way. You know, innovation and disruption is not just a brand new toy. It could be a toy that 10 people use, and now you can get 1,000 people to use, and that's disruption.
Yeah, you brought up, like, you want this great molecule that you develop, and you want to get it to as many patients as possible, as many people as possible, to have the broadest reach. But where are we going with, like, drug prices in the U.S.? It's kind of bananas. If you look at, today, a brand name topical fluoroquinolone, a brand name steroid, a brand name topical NSAID, the actual, like, full retail price of those combined, those three drops, is more than the surgeon fee for the cataract surgery. And so it gets to the point where in my own clinic, I just use compounded stuff now, where I buy it and give it to the patient for free. But how, and probably the most glaring example in all of ophthalmology, something we don't do, which is retina, where the retina surgeon is getting $100 to do the intravitreal injection, do all the work, assume all the liability, do all the billing, all the handling of product. The company's getting, what, like $1,800, $1,900, $2,000? Where's the balance here?
I know. But again, that's all within certain pillars and different pillars of the healthcare system. As physicians, we have not done a very good job in eye care and defending what we do. Everything once you put in... MIGS right now, right? MIGS is being attacked. Incredibly innovative, right? It came out 15 years ago. First is Glaukos, Sight Sciences, New World Medical, you know, Alcon, all great companies, right? All great companies. All of them are great. I respect them all. All MIGS matter. And now, you know, they only want to pay us $1.50 or $1.30 or $1.40 and so forth. It's a DMV mentality there that essentially you want to take something that's really, really big and cut costs. Like, you know, let's cut costs over here with something that's broad spectrum. Yet an amniotic lens, you get reimbursed $1,400 for it. And anyone can do it. You know, a fifth grader can do it. So that's what happens. So all these big ticket products, you know, are easy for the regulators to say, you know, we're going to clip this and clip that. Yeah, cataract surgery, when I came out of fellowship, I think it was paying close to $1,200, $1,500. Now it's down to, you know, $1,999. And now it's down to, you know, $480, $490. And of course, we do things to add on to it. But you can't force yourself to add on, because sometimes patients aren't the right, you know, customers for that, right? They may have an epiretinal membrane, or they may have drusen, or they may have bad dry eye. So it's tough. But again, luckily enough, we're volume. We do cataract surgery, several cases in an hour. If you have one or two rooms or three rooms, even more than that. You know, all my cousins, you have cousins too, who are physicians, who are in cardiology and GI and heart surgeons and breast surgeons and cancer surgeons, they're getting clipped also. I mean, it's only an attack on eye care. It's an attack on all of medicine.
I think it's physicians have no voice and no cohesion. And so I don't see like the anti-VEGF drugs getting cut in their reimbursement at all. I don't see any of the devices being cut in their reimbursements, but only the surgeon component being cut. Why? Why is this such an issue for us?
There has to be recalibration. And again, within healthcare, there's more of an effort towards prevention, towards primary care. They're actually getting elevated a little bit. Now, many of them have resorted to extenders and so forth. But yeah, the specialists in general are getting cut. And maybe, who knows, maybe at some point in time, the pricing, the reimbursement was too lofty. I'm not advocating for that, but there has to be a recalibration. But at some point, it's got to stop. And I do believe when we refresh the desktop in healthcare, that it will get better. But again, we have to make sure we remain on top of our game. We have good outcomes. You know, a lot of these companies, when they do drug pricing, they look at the lifetime of vision over 3, 5, 7 years. They look at health economics, outcomes, and research, you know, global evidence value is really, really important. And they put a price tag on what the opportunity cost would be if you didn't have the innovation, right? Or the drug and so forth. And that's how it works. We don't live in that. We don't live that if Uday Devlin does great cataract surgery on a patient, and now the patient won't have a hip fracture or won't fall and so forth, and will remember when they see their children. And we know for a fact that 30% reduction in progression of dementia with cataract surgery in your 70s, which came out a couple of years ago, I have that actually plastered all over our big screen television in our waiting room. And patients are like, you know what? And for me too, only 8 years ago, the average age for cataract surgery was 71. Now it's actually 64. It's actually below Medicare age. So, you know, things are getting moving more and more towards a younger age population, people living longer and so forth. But at some point in time, especially with a dearth of ophthalmologists in the next 5 years, and optometrists for that matter, we're going to need other tools to remain successful. There is a lot of consolidation occurring out there in the market, but we're going to need tools to be more successful in our practices. So
what kind of tools?
Well, I think AI, I think augmented intelligence is going to be important. I don't buy that AI is going to replace you and me. A robot won't replace you and me. But just like you and I used Optos years ago and used OCT years ago to look at the macula in certain ways or topography in certain ways, to me, augmented intelligence can be really important. You know, how can I use data from a million people that have had cataract surgery on a Zeiss device using an IOL master, and how can I really titrate the patient's vision to what they want, right? I mean, the LAL has showed us that we have the ability to do a lot postoperatively. And I still believe that the perioperative journey for patients is going to be important. We're going to use digital medicine. We learned during COVID that telehealth is here to stay. We probably accelerated digital medicine by at least 6 to 7 years. A lot of folks are into it. Amazon, Google, McKesson, all these great companies.
Are you using telehealth now in your ophthalmology clinic?
No, we were up to 200 telehealth visits a week. During, wow. I was, at one point, I was in boxers with scruff and longer hair. Because we were out for 3 months here in northern New Jersey, Uday. But so we were doing up to 200 telehealth using Doximity a week. Now we're like 5 times a month. Maybe that glaucoma patient is a bit cranky, doesn't want to come in. So you know what? I just do a telehealth with Dr. J and so forth. And that's fine. It's an adjuvant tool in how we take care of our patients.
It's better than nothing.
it's better than nothing. And as long as the payers are paying for that and so forth, fine, they're paying for it. It's okay. It's part of the model. But I do believe that AI, in my case, I define AI as artificial. Augmented is going to be very, very important. It's going to help you and I as better cataract surgeons. The retinologist is better retinal surgeons. And I think we have all this data out there. And if we amalgamate that data towards better outcomes in our practices, I think it's going to lead for, you know, better eye care.
So it's interesting. You never kind of know where it ends up. I mean, I've always been bad at predicting the future, relatively speaking, but I've been great at adapting to it. I think sometimes that's arguably more important.
Take care of today, maybe tomorrow, the rest will take care of itself, you know. But yeah, adapting to the future is really, really important. You and I give a lot of talks for a lot of different companies. I love, of course, the Hawaiian Eyes and the OSNs and Academy are great. We end up talking to ourselves more, you know, more times than not, but giving talks and just meeting the heartland of eye care, folks that are still using, you know, older medications, combination therapies for post-op cataract surgery or using just tears for the ocular surface and talking to them and so forth. I enjoy that the most. It's almost like running for Senate or running for governor. You shake hands with people that don't go to the meetings and just are taking care of patients, just doing the best they can and taking care of their staff. I enjoy that the most because they see folks like us, like, you know, they get inspired. But to me, that's where eye care is, right? It's not the folks that are going to the meetings. We all go to the meetings all the time. But as the folks that are staying back, maybe go to one meeting a year and are just taking care of patients, you know, many days a week and so forth. And I think that's the heartland of eye care. And I remain very bullish about it. I think if innovation were to stop Uday today or tomorrow, we'd be in a great place. You know, we're all doing cataract surgery within several minutes. We have MIGS, we have TriFam Blue, we have the Malugin Ring, we have Phaco Flip, Phaco Chop, whatever platform you're doing. You got the J&Js, the Alcons, the Bausch & Lomb's that are all working towards giving us better tools. But that said, all their platforms are really, really good today. We don't need to innovate anymore, but that's just the nature of who we are. We want the iPhone 17. We want the iPhone 19. We just do. So despite what the payers say, we're going to continue moving forward in a very innovative way.
Well, then do you think that evolves into patients then having to foot the bill out of their own pocket? Because there's a lot of reluctance for payers and especially like government payers to reimburse.
Look, we live in class warfare. We just do. For healthcare, we live in class warfare. A lot of folks will come see me for a second, third opinion. They're willing to pay out of pocket for it. A lot of folks will go here in New York, New Jersey, you know, hospital for special surgery, HSS, and pay out of pocket for it, or at Sloan Kettering, and then take that bill and submit the insurance company. So we live in class warfare. The great thing about our country is we have good access to healthcare for almost anyone. You get shot on the street, you get into an accident, you have a heart attack, there's a great city hospital nearby that'll take care of you. That's a great place. But will everyone want to get care that way? No. And, you know, someone who has a strong family history of breast cancer and she's 36 years young and wants to get a mammogram and the insurance company says no, she's going to pay for it out of pocket. So right. I just think that aspect is always going to be there. We see it in cataract surgery. A lot of folks want, you know, an LRI. They want, you know, blended vision. They want a multifocal. They want an EDOF. They want LAL. And yes, there's always going to be, in economics, there's always going to be a buyer. There's always going to be a seller. And you don't have to sell to everyone, okay? But the least common denominator is at least taking good care of patients. So time and time again, and we have a great percentage of folks that upgrade to something more than plain cataract surgery. But for those that don't, it's less than 5%. We still take care of them because we're able to tuck them in into, you know, one of our surgical suites, and in 10 minutes we're done. And you feel good about it. You know, at the end of the day, you and I took the Hippocratic Oath in medical school, but we also took it in residency to take care of our patients who otherwise have very bad vision. And you show these great, great videos, and I look at them every day, and so do my colleagues. And you say it's only for a certain demographic. No, I have folks that are post-50 that are watching your videos and say, oh, did you watch Uday's video? I mean, really, I'm really happy where you've gone with this. It's awesome. And we take care of white cataracts. Probably 25% of our cataracts are hypermature. They all go see the urologist first, and they have 3 millimeter pupils. Then they see me, and I'm like, you've gone to me first, and then the urologist or the primary care doctor. And it's great. I mean, I think some of the biggest things of innovation in cataract surgery that is a pass-through, essentially, and we don't worry about the cost. We just care about the innovation, is the Melugan ring and TriFan Blow. I mean, God, it's a fantastic, fantastic. And I'll do whatever it takes to use those products to help the patient see better. And it's very gratifying. I mean, a lot of our colleagues will post on Instagram with their patients. And I look at them and I don't post as much. But it's great to rejoice and have a patient see. So I don't mind doing that. It's a Robin Hood mentality. For those that pay us extra, it's able for us to run our businesses, feel good about what we're doing, and give it to the people that otherwise can't afford that.
No, I'm sorry. For sure.
Right?
For sure.
And it's a great feeling. We have, you know, and you and I are going to keep on going at least for 10, 15 years in active cataract surgery. And then we'll start doing lasers.
I got 20 in me. I'm doing
it. I got 20. Okay, I'll match you year to year. 20 here.
But you know, I think one of the most amazing miracles in all of medicine is getting a white cataract. And in your beautiful, elegant surgery that looks like a ballet, the patient's vision is instantly restored. That's a miracle, no question.
Actively doing LASIK, you know, people at the table, oh, can you see the clog? And there's a lot of hype with that. Of course, I get it. I had the same guy who's a cricket player who is actually a British Indian. Came to this country 6 years ago, had a cricket ball, and the cricket balls are harder than baseballs, by the way.
Right.
Those balls are real. When I play with my cousins going back from here, back home to Bombay to visit cousins for a few weeks, I got hit in the head a few times. Those are hard balls. They're really hard. But he had a cricket ball injury, white as white cataract. I mean, white as white, and a small pupil. He was also on Flomax. And I took out his cataract, you know, Melugan ring, TriFan Blue. We were done in, you know, a couple of several minutes. And on the table, he goes, Dr. J, I can see. And the anesthesiologist looked in and the nurses. And it was just a really cool moment. We had some cool jazz in the background. It was awesome. It was awesome. And he didn't pay for an upgraded lens. He couldn't even afford an LRI. I did the LRI for free for him. He was, you know, a doctor at 180. It was a really, really good feeling. I just saw him 2 days ago. You know, he's 20-25, uncorrected. I feel so happy. Now he's going to play baseball with, not cricket anymore, he's going to play baseball with his grandsons. You know, again, that's what we do. That's what we do. We talk about, if everyone's premium, who's going to take care of the rest of those patients?
No, of course.
Luckily,
of course,
you and I can take care of all those. And you did that for so many years, you know, at City Hospital, right? You're teaching residents. And by the way, Sumit Shah, my good buddy, and NJ Ratna down the street, we co-manage a lot of cases. He says great things. He says hello to you, by the way.
He's one of your residents. He now does retina there in New Jersey. He was spectacular.
He's a fantastic guy, yeah.
incredible work ethic. He was the type you ever tell him, it's okay to go home now.
He tells me as a retina guy that Uday is really tough on me, but man, I learned so much, and it made me today a much better surgeon. And he's a retina guy.
Oh, I'm honored. I'm honored. But, you know, let's go back to the white cataract for a minute, because I really want to borrow your business expertise here. So I posted a video on Cataract Coach with a white cataract, and I made a comment in the video like, okay, yeah, I'm going to use TriFan Blue Dye. Here in my surgery center, our net cost is $66 for the vial. And the comments that followed from people around the world, because, you know, it's a very worldwide audience for Cataract Coach, were like, $66? In my country, it's less than a dollar. It's pennies.
That's so, okay.
No, I get it, but we're still in that same situation where, like, you know, we've got to do something, not just ophthalmology, I mean across medicine, to rein in some of these bananas drug prices. And yes, while I get there has to be innovation and you pay for R&D, et cetera, as a stockholder of many of these companies, wow, I'm thankful for like all the revenue. The stock keeps going up.
Yeah, I mean, companies have to recoup their costs. You know, R&D costs quite a bit of money. It takes many, many years. Clinical development,
it
can cost hundreds of millions of dollars, a couple of billion dollars, you know, and for the bigger caps like immunology and so forth. I have cousins that are on a lot of drugs from, you know, who have immunological disorders and so forth. Thank God. One cousin who was a runner had cardiomyopathy, and thank God Entresto, made by Novartis, has prolonged his life. So we need innovation too and so forth. And as long as people have access to it. Yeah, I mean, I'm a business guy, and I run, you know, two surgery centers, and I'm also on the board of trustees at the hospital, and we look at the things, but we have a mission to take care of all patients. And as long as it's value positive and cost neutral, I'm okay. And the profitability per case of the surgery center is a few more dollars for that for that case, it's fine because the rest of those cases in the Robin Hood mentality are paying for that. Because right, what are you going to do, not use TriFam Blue?
No, come on.
You're not going to use a Melligan ring. You use Iris hooks, which are fine, but that causes a whole hyperopic shift. It's like operating like this. No, I mean, these are, come on here. These are really, really important tools. And when we're teaching residents and fellows, you want them to have all these things. I mean, it's important to learn how to suture and do different techniques that we've talked about in Cataract Coach. But nonetheless, Uday,
right,
we want our patients to have the best outcomes. But our specialty is very outcome-driven.
Right.
You don't know what your kidney function is until 99% of your nephron is gone and damaged. And glaucoma could be like that too. But the rest of it, you know. And when things have gone wrong postoperatively, 1 or 2 weeks later, you just know and you call that patient, like, oh, you know what? Yeah, you've got some dry eye or you have some CME and so forth. So our next patient may not have a good outcome. It's very binary. So that's how I go in with every patient I see, whether it's in the office or in the OR. And I just love it because it, you know, yeah, it humbles me every single moment. And whether I'm watching your video or something on iTube or I'm at a meeting or I'm seeing patients, I learn from every single, you know, we now have done tens of thousands of cases. I learn from every single case. And if two cases are similar, it makes me an expert compared to who I am. And I just think, going back to the Apple analogy, you and I in our lifetime, we'll get to the iPhone 22 or 23, maybe even 24, maybe 25.
Wow.
But we have to do that as physicians and leaders,
right,
for our residents and fellows. And I'm happy that there's been a huge gentrification in eye care. And some of these younger folks are now going to meetings and being part of it because eye care is very exciting. And we don't make the most money. We just don't. We don't. Look at all the Medscape, you know, surveys. We just don't. But we make a difference for our patients every single moment. It's so gratifying.
Right, absolutely. Let me switch gears here just for a second. You have obviously Duke MBA, which is fantastic. You have a huge business experience in not only your own practice, but also in working the corporate side. What business lessons or pearls can you give to your average Joe ophthalmologist in practice? Joe or Josephine ophthalmologist in practice. What advice can you give them? What are some of those lessons? I think we touched on some of them.
Not everyone needs to go to business school. Sometimes MBAs screw things up in corporations and in a business. How many times have surgery centers hire these high-powered MBAs to run a surgery center? And I still think the best surgery centers are run by surgeons who have a business sense. So either you have the business sense or surround yourself with people, a good manager or someone around you that has a good business sense. Go to the meetings, challenge your partners, challenge your associates. Look at the P&L. It goes down to, you know what? When you leave your bedroom in a big house or a small house and you don't eat anymore, turn the lights off. Just be efficient. Have that middle-class work ethic. Appreciate the value of the money, right? We all have, you know, staff that work at $18, $19, $20, $25, $30 an hour. Appreciate what they're going through and realize the value of money and realize the value of running a business, running a surgery center. You don't have to be doing it yourself, but surround yourself with that is really, really important. Whether you get into industry and start consulting and doing this, that's all based on what you want to do. There are many ways to contribute to the macro of healthcare. And as long as you enjoy what you're doing throughout the day, I do a lot of nonprofit work. I do a lot of charitable work at the hospital. And I've always believed that ophthalmology has been thrown out of healthcare systems. Really, the money makers are cancer, heart, and orthopedics.
Yeah.
But you know, I do a lot with the hospital still. I still do enough cases there. I've made it a surgery center mentality there. And I've given them a big business sense in outcomes in eye care and what efficiency means. We can't have a 1 hour turnaround time in eye care when the case takes me, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes. We have to have innovation. I have to have different MIGs at my disposal because all MIGs matter. There's different ways to take care of these patients. So not everyone has to have an MBA, but I think we should all have a sense of money. Right? It's not even a business sense, but the sense of money, I think, is really, really important. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a brand new associate, ask your partners, you know what, how am I doing? How much money am I bringing in and so forth? Just be sensible so people can respect you. Because when you know business, you know money, I think there's a newfound respect for you. Otherwise, everyone's just flippantly and frivolously using money and, oh, I don't care if I use, you know, 5 viscoelastics here, it's fine. No, you have to have a sense and a common sense mentality. And it really goes back to that middle class work ethic that we all had. You know, I had a lemonade stand growing up. You know, it's, you know, it's just, I was charging $1 for it. You know, it's important. You have to have a business. And you and I are probably more business minded than most people, but, either you have it or surround yourself with people that know. Otherwise you'll be taken advantage of, within eye care, within healthcare for sure.
Well, I think if you bring up a good point, knowing actually what's going on here, what are the costs involved here? I remember telling residents when you're attending them and they open another business class, I'm like, okay, that's $80. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah. You want 5 tubes? There's $400. I'm like, really? Like, I didn't realize.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you got to be cognizant of all the factors involved. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, if we can't run a good business, we can't help any patients.
You can't win patients. And you can't hire more people. And you can't give out bonuses. It's all very important. Also, don't have the shutters on, right? I mean, we're in eye care, but we're also in healthcare. So read the Wall Street Journal, read the New York Times, you know, learn how geopolitical forces in different parts of the world during time of war or COVID can impact your businesses. Look, we all learned it a couple of years ago. 9/11 was tough. I was around there for that time too, but this COVID was pretty tough. We all went home for a couple of months and we had no idea how we were going to run our businesses, right? I mean, that edict came from David Park and the American Academy of Ophthalmology. It was a very intense feeling for us here in New Jersey, in Northern Jersey. People were passing away because of COVID, right? Other parts of the country may not experience that, and I respect that, but in New Jersey, they did. So it was important. We had to learn how to work through that loan that we got from the government, take care of staff, be holistic, realize that we are providers for people, and we had to do the right thing. So you have to have a business sense. You just have to. If you keep a wallet or if you have Apple Pay on your phone, you have to have a business sense.
So where do we go in ophthalmology? What's coming for us 5 years, 10 years from now? You have a great sense of this. Where's ophthalmology, at least in the USA or maybe even worldwide, where are we headed?
I think worldwide there's a lot more opportunity probably because we have more regulations here in the US, as you're talking about before, class warfare, drug pricing and so forth. But that said, I think ophthalmology is going to be in a great space. I still think we have more room in cataract surgery, a better accommodating IOL. We're seeing this year that dry eye has been turned upside down with some new entrants in the market to treat MGD. One's for Demodex, one is for MGD and so forth. So, I mean, there's a lot in glaucoma. We have MIGS coming out still. There's still more MIGS coming out. And despite what the payers are saying, we need to be more innovative that way. You know, 15 years ago, we couldn't even spell MIGS. And now it's become commonplace, right? I think corneal surgery has a lot way to go. Transplantation, can we infuse cells? DWEC, which include not, you know, putting an implant in the eye and essentially having cells grow in there. I mean, it's a lot of excitement there, a lot.
Right.
Digital medicine, I think, is going to have a huge play. It already has in radiology, cardiology, derm, pathology, but I think in eye care, diabetic retinopathy, and that's why I'm involved with a small company in Miami looking at AI. Diabetic retinopathy is FDA approved. I think hopefully with geographic atrophy, ocular surface disease, we'll have some AI algorithms there too. So I'm very bullish about eye care. But again, if nothing changed and I just do this for the next 5 years the way I'm doing it, I'm okay. If I can go to meetings and have a latte or a beer with you, Uday, I'm okay. Because we're all in a great spot. And whether you're in academic medicine or a private equity-backed group or hybrid or private practice, there's many, many ways to practice. And I think for the residents and fellows that I help train at New York Eye and Ear every year, I tell them the world is yours and your fellowship is your fellowship. So for the corny guys that are coming, like, listen, you need to know how to treat glaucoma. There's a new branch, it's called anterior segment. And, you right. know, I'm not saying do trabs and do valves, but you're in there anyway, you know, put in an eye stent, you know, do a little, you know, trabeculotomy, do a goniotomy, you know, take care of the patient while you're there anyway. So it's that mindset there, right? That's really, really important. And I think people are hungry. They're seeing your videos, they're looking at iTube, they're going to meetings, all these great, I love the smaller meetings now. Of course, AAO is great. It's the hand that fed us when we were much younger. ARVO's great. I love those meetings. But, you know, OSN, Hawaiian Eye, Kiowa Eye, and Millennial Eye, all these new meetings are fantastic because there's more boutique.
What about your two meetings, Aspen's and Cedars?
Cedars Aspen's great. It's one of the things that I do. It's not the only thing I do, but it's fantastic. Vanguard, ACOS, These are all meetings that you've got. I mean, they're all great meetings. And again, you don't have to go to every single one. You got to see patients, right? But industry's embraced it, and it's a lot of fun to catch up. And that's why I go to the meetings. I go to the meetings not to learn from the podium, per se. It's just to go to and meet with people at Starbucks or a cafe and have a glass of wine during happy hour and learn, hey, Uday, what are you doing latest and greatest, you know, or where are you going to? I went to ESCRS a couple of weeks ago, and it was just so much fun seeing what world leaders are doing that may not have as many regulatory pressures or pricing pressures, right? The guys from India, Australia, Germany, they're just fantastic guys. So, you know, vision is still a worldwide problem. And I think we need more strides there, where there's more access to care issues for a lot of people around the world. But here in the U.S., the payer aspect is going to be an important one. As they start to minimize what we're doing, I worry that companies may dry up with R&D and say, you know what, we can't afford this innovation anymore. We can't be in MIGS. We can't be in ocular surface. We can't be in retina. I do worry about that. And as every big company comes in there and gobbles up the smaller companies because they can't scale up, we're going to need the regrowth, the regeneration of smaller boutique companies that are focusing on one or two assets, right? I understand that scale is important, but innovation also occurs at some of these smaller companies that have a mission statement.
Right.
You know, and right, when you and I were starting out, it was ISTA, it was Inspire, great companies. Aerie, a couple of years ago, Kayla had the first steroid for dry eye. I mean, you know, these are great ones, but the payers make it tough and scale is really tough. So we're going to need the Alcons and the Bausch Shalom's and the J&J's. They're all great, great companies. But eye care is also about the smaller companies too. We're in a great incubator called eye care, Uday.
Yeah, you need the whole spectrum, obviously.
The whole spectrum.
It's easy. When you're a small company, you can maneuver very quick and easy. Whereas when you're a big, big company, yeah, you have bigger assets, but it's also harder to kind of make those rapid turns and changes.
Right.
What advice do you give? I know our ophthalmologists on Cataract Coach for their videos and our podcasts are across the board, from age like mid to late 20s to probably, you know, age 80-something. But in general, we have a lot of people in the 30s and 40s who like our podcasts, like our videos. If you could look back to 26-year-old Jay just finishing med school, going for, you know, starting your career, what advice would you give? What advice would you give to the young ophthalmologists out there today who are just finishing their training, just starting practice? What are some good pearls?
The pearls are life pearls. You know, achieve balance. You know, find some good friends. Find good outlets. Don't let things get to you.
Wait, achieve balance. Wait a minute. I thought you were working 168 hours a week.
No, I said I live 168. I don't work 40. I live 168. And then I go backwards. Do the math today, Uday, and text me tomorrow on how many hours left you have to still be productive. I'm serious. You know, in ophthalmology, you're going to have a very productive week with working hardcore like you do and I do, 26 to 30 hours a week. But I do see a lot of people have built into, oh, I got to go to Arvo and produce, and I got to score the highest on my boards and this and that. And that's great, right? But once you're done and you're done with your fellowship or your residency and your first couple years out, you know, learn from your peers, learn from the staff, touch people, touch the common people, because they're the ones that will be giving you blood. Chances are your senior partners won't give you blood if you need blood. It's going to be the common man, and ours still a common man specialty. It really is, because vision is a problem. You lose half of one eye, it's a problem. So, and achieving balance, you know, finding the right friend circle, the right partners, the right spouse, whatever it is, whatever you're into, just, you know, and have something else that you believe in, right, besides eye care. Have an outlet. It could be wine. It could be a coffee connoisseur, a golfer. I know Billy mentioned this to you a few weeks ago. Bill Troutler on my pickleball. I've been taking a pickleball now recently.
Nice.
I'm getting more and more into golf. I have a baseball swing. That's my problem. But pickleball has been a lot of fun. We go to Hilton Head every year. We play all week long. And then I play, you know, here locally. But have something else, you know, because eye care should not consume you for 168 hours a week. You know, even a strong work week, you're making an impact. Go to meetings, challenge yourselves, not only at the meetings, but challenge yourselves on the videos. Look forward to the Cataract Coach video and see what's out there. And again, if you amalgamate all the great pearls you've had, I live those pearls. I've had white cataracts every week, how to do different phaco techniques, cool cases coming from around the world. It's awesome. I thought the NIAG a YAG to penetrate that white anterior capsule that you had a couple of days ago. I haven't done that yet. I'm not sure I would do that one.
Yeah, I haven't done it either, but you know, I wanted to have a complete library of everything for counter.
You got everything now.
Now it's complete.
But I think that balance is key. Balance is key.
Well, you hammered home the point that, you know, you've got to keep learning. You can be mid-career. You can be 20 years into your career. You can't stop learning. You got to keep learning every year as you progress.
Yeah. And, you know, go to the meetings and come back with even two or three pearls and execute those pearls and implement them. You know, maybe take a longer time in the case and do that extra step, right? You could be doing, you know, the McCabe, you know, belt technique, loop technique, whatever it may be, right? Just use those things. Don't give up cases so quickly and refer them out. You know, think about it, right? It's just a lot of fun. You know, master the exam. Yeah, challenge yourself. It's just really, really important. And again, you will become an expert in no time. And also realize you can't do everything, right? When I came out of residency and fellowship, I was doing TRAVs my first 2 years, some STRAB cases, and my partner's like, oh, we did everything in our time. Like, that was back in the 60s and 70s. Now I've got peds ophthalmologists around me. I don't want to be so greedy. I want patients to have the best outcomes possible. They can go. I mean, of course, I was in a different part of the country. It'd be a different story. But you know, here in Northern Jersey, we have 20 guys like you, 10 guys like Bill Trattler, and 5 guys like me within a 5-mile radius. And we live in a community. We're not that competitive. We're all part of surgery centers. It's a really, really great community on a local level and a regional level. And just be real. You know, be real. And also engage yourself with healthcare. You know, be part of the hospital. Go to grand rounds. Speak to the internists. Because they're the ones that are feeding you patients ultimately, right? Because a lot of these things are based on referrals and so forth. Right. So I know a lot of folks work with the optometrists. They're great. You know, we now have a new specialty called Eye Care Professionals, Ophthalmology and Optometry. But not all those models work everywhere. And engage yourselves, right? I do a lot at the hospital level. It's a very, very big part of what I do. I'm on the board. I head up strategy for the hospital. And that takes up for me 15, 20 hours a week. And I just love it because I feel like this is the doctor in me. This is the internist in me years ago, coming back and walking around and feeling comfortable in my skin, taking care of eye care problems. But again, also as being a doctor, right? It's a great thing. It's right now impossible to get into medical school. I'm not sure I would have gotten in when I did, and you and I got in earlier in these combined programs. But let me just tell you something. I'm just happy. Just happy, and we're in a great specialty. And even if cataract surgery goes down to 380, I'll still be doing it. Because, you know, if I can do it in a couple of minutes in a fast, efficient way, I've given someone the value of seeing well. And that's priceless.
No, what we do is amazing. There's no question about that. But, no, that's a lot of food for thought here. A lot of great business pros you gave us today. I loved your advice about, you know, having that passion, how we treat the whole spectrum of patients. How we got to look at the big picture. And of course, being involved in the business side of it. Sometimes we get too removed from that. And I probably don't do enough with general medicine and the hospital systems, this and that. I'm a little bit more removed. But it's making me think that maybe I should kind of put a little more effort in for that.
Oh, it's been, and we don't do it for any business reason, but it's we have easily 150 physicians who are endocrinologists, family practitioners, internists that refer to us every week. They don't want anything back. All they want is a patient getting good care. So it could be diabetic retinopathy, dry eye, corneal ulcer, red eye. Look, remember that Will's Eye Manual we lived by for years in residency? Live that once in a while. We all do great cases in the OR, but you know, live that once in a while. At the end of the day, you're still a specialist. You know, being a general ophthalmologist, you're still a specialist. Chances are you're graduating, you're the top of your class in medical school, you did well on the boards, you had to do all those things, all those hoops, and by darn, you're still a specialist, and you're still affecting vision. And even when you're done as a surgeon, and your hands may have a bit of a tremor, or you feel like it's taking you longer than you should, or you're dropping too many lenses or something, medical ophthalmology is great.
Right.
I love being in the office and seeing a lot of patients. I love it.
Yeah, shift gears.
Do a few lasers, do some plugs, do some amniotic grafts. Yeah, you get a lot of love and all these sweets and these pastries and these bottles of wine from patients. You know, they're just happy. You take care of that emergency. I never say no to emergencies. If I'm walking out at 3:30 and someone comes in 10 minutes late and they got a red eye, I'm going to take care of them. I don't want them with a red eye all night long, and they could have scleritis, uveitis, or a corneal erosion or something fungal. I don't know what it is. I'm going to take care of them. You do that, that brings you 10, 15 more patients, and that whole family for that patient. We're already specialized. Everyone's just getting ultra, ultra specialized. Like, you know, that's fine, but remember, general ophthalmology is a specialty in itself, you know?
That's true. And I got to ask you, do you still maintain your board certification in the American Board of Internal Medicine?
Hell no! I'm trying to figure out how many more times I can take the Board of Ophthalmology exam, which I love, by the way. I just love that. I'm a geek. I love reading.
I love studying too. Don't get me wrong, but I question: do we need this exam that has a beyond 99% pass rate every 10 years, which you're now doing those quarterly questions? Is this just a money grab? Can we be honest, or is it really something valuable from it? I don't know. I don't know the answers.
I think the insurance companies just want to make sure that, you know, again, there's all these barriers to entry, and I think the insurance companies want it too. You know, if it's a money grab, it's fine.
How is it a barrier if it's a beyond 99% pass rate, right?
No, I know. But I know at the hospital level, if you're not board certified or you're taking your research, you have two shots at it, and then they let you go. So from that point of view, it's important. From the governance point of view, I mean, I know a lot of our friends are grandfathered before 1992. I'm all for it, but I agree with you. At one point when they first came out, it was like really tedious. You had to go to this testing center, and I was taking tests with these people taking their PSATs. I felt so small. So now it's gotten easier over a cup of coffee, even a glass of wine. You can do these questions and so forth. It's fun. I'm okay with it. You know, people have got to make money and support foundations. I'm okay with it. We do well.
No, I get it. It's just that on the American Board of Internal Medicine side, there have been a lot of recent controversy.
People, I know. I've not done the research for that one. Are you crazy? But I do. I loved cardiology. So, you know what I love? When patients come in and we get the intake from the tech on all the medications they're on, I always love these medications that people are on. And if I can't figure it out, I go home, I read up on what that medication does. And some of them have side effects in eye care. Right now, there's a big push with Ozempic and so forth. And now we're seeing some issues with that, with eyes, with anesthesia, with birth control pills, because you're delaying, you know, gastric emptying. So, yeah. You know, it's interesting. You know, I think, again, we deal with metabolic syndrome and metabolic retinopathy. I think it's going to, you know, this whole sudden weight loss for a lot of people is going to probably impact what we see in eye care too. I think we're in a great space.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jay, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I love learning so much from you. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, you are exceptionally bright. And I certainly came across in this podcast.
I don't want to be the brightest guy in the room. I want to be the nicest guy in the room. That's my goal.
You know what? You're both, though. That's even better.
I'm not sure about that, but I want to be the nicest guy in the room. Uday, I'm really proud of you. I love the journey. I hope Cataract Coach is in perpetuity. I'm telling you, it's impacted so many people recently. A lot of the people that are on the podium with you at all these big meetings are big followers of you. You know, it could be Eric Donnefeld, John Hovenacian, Billy Troutler, D.P. Dhaliwal. These just awesome people that have made a big difference in eye care, and it's great. So we're really proud of you, and no one can touch you. Just keep on doing it. Priceless. It's priceless. You know, the best things in life are priceless. And I'm really proud of you. Keep on doing it.
And Cataract Coach is free. And it's the best things are free too. There you go.
I know. So I'll send you a video when I get a chance. Pretty cool cataract surgery. Like you know, we've all gotten better in time and so forth. So I'll send you a video or two in the coming months.
Yeah, if you can send me a nice video, we'll be able to feature it the day after your podcast is the feature video of the day.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, man. We'll see ya.